Welcome to a special edition of the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson, and this week, our guest is one of the greatest broadcasters ever, Bob Costas, who has lived one of the most interesting lives in the history of our profession, has been at all the biggest moments in sports for generations, also one of the most accomplished interviewers and just one of the smartest, coolest, funniest people around. And this is one of our favorite interviews we've ever done. What makes Bob so great as a broadcaster is he knows how to not overspeak or have anything really be boring. So we ended up doing like a half hour sit down with him, and I had to trim some of it out for TV, not because it wasn't great, just because I had to hit an arbitrary number. But for the purpose of the podcast, you get to hear all of it, which is a better version of it. Most people, unfortunately, are better when they're trimmed down. Bob Costas is so perfect the way that it comes out, you really don't want to touch it. So this is the best version of the conversation. Bob, in full, touching on a bunch of topics from the Super Bowl to LeBron James to Tom Brady to baseball to cheating to sports betting to his favorite broadcasters he's worked with to some of the legends of the game who he thinks are some of the best. We play personal issues. There's a lot here, and it's a real gem, and I hope you enjoy it as much as we enjoyed doing it. So, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Costas. I think the greatest sports broadcaster of all time, Bob Costas, here on set. Welcome back to The Issue Is.
You cannot say this in Southern California. The longtime base of operations of Vin Scully.
Well, yeah.
The best anyone else can do is take the silver.
Okay, that's fair.
You know?
I think of Vin just as, in terms of baseball, although he did it all.
He did a lot of things.
He did it all. I think you more overall. And we hope that Al Michaels is watching. Okay, so
we'll be having dinner with Al actually 2 days ago by the time this airs.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start. It is Super Bowl week. You've been a part of so many Super Bowls, as has Al Michaels.
Yes.
Chiefs versus Eagles, your thoughts?
You know, I don't follow it as closely as I once did when I was covering it. The last full season I covered the NFL for NBC was 2016. I think it's a heck of a matchup. The Eagles have a better team overall, but as good as Jalen Hurts is, Mahomes has the advantage there. So it would seem to me, lots of things can happen in a single game, but it would seem to me that if the Chiefs win this game, then Mahomes has to have a terrific game for that to happen.
Let's talk more broadly about the Super Bowl itself, because it has become a cultural experience unlike anything else in America. Mm-hmm. And at this time in America, we're all so divided. Everybody's looking at their phone all day, but yet over 100 million people watch this. What do you think that other sports can learn from what the NFL has done right in terms of building a massive live audience?
Actually, very little, because the nature of football and the way it's scheduled is to their enormous advantage. One game a week, obviously their game's on Monday and on Thursday, but essentially your team plays once a week, generally on a weekend, generally during a time of the year when people are at home in much of the country where the weather isn't all that good. And most important, as you build toward the postseason, every playoff game in the NFL is the equivalent of a seventh game in baseball, basketball, or hockey. Look how the ratings improve exponentially between a game six and a game seven in any of those sports. They still don't reach Super Bowl levels, but they take an enormous jump. Every one of the playoff games in the NFL is all or nothing. You know, gambling has always been part of it. Now gambling's even a bigger part of it because it's more out in the open. Football televises very well, if you can put the essential brutality of the game aside. And I think many people who cover it, many people who watch it, make some kind of deal in their own mind with it. They know the nature of it. They know what's happening, not just the specific things that happen on the field, but the attrition and the people who at age 50 won't remember where they left their keys or how to drive home or what their kids' names are. And that's not an exaggeration. Even the NFL now itself acknowledges that between 25 and 30% of those who play football for any period of time will have some sort of neurological or mental acuity difficulties down the road. As a group, football players are healthier than other people of comparable age because of their general level of fitness, mm-hmm. because of their relative wealth and access to good health care. But when it comes to brain trauma and neurological damage, not the case. Bad.
I mean, clearly a lot of people, though, are making that bargain.
Yes, they do.
The top 75 out of the 100 broadcasts last year were all NFL games. Are you making that bargain? Are you watching football now that you don't have to watch it for a living? Does that bother you? Do you think about that?
Oh, it bothers me, and I made that clear. My ambivalence about it is why I'm no longer doing it. Now, I absolutely recognize the drama, the excitement, the strategy, the shared experience, the appeal of it. And many of the finest people I've met in sports have been football people, coaches, front office people, players. So it's not that I feel negatively toward them, but I just recognize that there's a contradiction within the game. It bothers some people more than others. It bothered me enough that I no longer wanted to be front and center covering it. But having said that, will I watch the Super Bowl? Do I watch the playoff games? Yes. But this is an honest answer to your question. If you asked me most Mondays or Thursdays, who's playing tonight, I wouldn't know. And it's been a very long time since I made any sort of plan for a day around regular season football. If I'm around and I turn it on and it's in the fourth quarter and it's a close game, I know the rules. I know the dynamics of the game. Right. I can engage with it. But it's not central to my life anymore.
Meanwhile, a historic week in basketball, another mm-hmm. sport that you covered closely for so many years.
And which I still love.
LeBron James becoming the all-time leading scorer in NBA history.
Yeah.
Can you put that in some historical context? What does that record mean?
Well, it means a hell of a lot, especially because of the guy who held it, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's one of the greatest players in history. Almost by definition, you hold a record like that, you have to be among the greatest players in history. Is it another feather in LeBron's cap? It most certainly is. But by way of comparison, LeBron has won one season scoring title. Kareem won a handful. Michael Jordan won 10. Mm. Michael Jordan averaged 30.1 points a game for his career, exactly the same as Wilt Chamberlain. They're the two tops in that category. LeBron's points per game, actually, at this advanced stage of late, he's averaging 30-plus points a game. But he hasn't scored at the same clip that Jordan did, but he has more rebounds.
And more assists.
He has more assists. He is a tremendous player. As he's said himself, he could play any position on the court. If he had to, he could play center. He could certainly play the three, the four, the one,
right.
the two.
And he would say that he's a pass-first player.
He is.
Which is amazing that he's gotten this scoring record.
He absolutely is. It's so difficult to compare across eras.
Right.
When Michael Jordan played, and the reason we're talking about this is that it's come down to Jordan and LeBron in the argument. With all due respect to Kobe or Magic.
Or Kareem.
Or Kareem or Larry Bird. But my feeling is that when you talk about Kareem, I don't think that centers should be separate, not lesser, but separate. To talk about Kareem or Wilt or Olajuwon or Shaq or Bill Russell in the same breath as LeBron and Michael, I don't mean to say in the same breath that they're not equal, but it's a different thing. It's like comparing pitchers to position players or goalies to defensemen and forwards in hockey. Mm-hmm. It's entirely different. So I put them in a separate category, not lesser. But when it comes down to forwards and guards, it's LeBron and Michael, so it seems. But when you think about the era in which they played, the game in which LeBron broke Kareem's record, the final score was 133-130. That's not terribly atypical these days. It would be very atypical in Jordan's era. The last game that Michael Jordan played, perhaps his most famous game, when he made the classic shot.
Which you called.
The one-point deficit into a one-point championship win over the Jazz. Final score is 87-86. Michael Jordan scored 45 points. So proportionately, that's a different achievement. That doesn't clinch the argument, but there's a little bit of apples and oranges going on here because the circumstances are very different.
But does LeBron breaking this record change your view at all about about Michael Jordan being the greatest ever?
No, I think it's another notch on the resume for LeBron, And he was already on the very short list of the greatest players who ever played in any era. But I've always said this, though, and this has nothing to do with a statistical comparison. If we're just talking about basketball in a vacuum, you've got a LeBron, Jordan argument, and cases can be made for either. But if you're talking about the overall impact through no fault of LeBron's, that's Jordan in a runaway. Michael Jordan's impact on the game and on its popularity has something to do not only with his excellence, but his presence. He was an incredibly pleasing and compelling player to watch. Not that LeBron isn't, but there are degrees right. of things. And Jordan was at the highest level, what occupied by only a very few in the history of sports, any sport. And I've taken to saying it this way. No little old lady in Omaha ever said, I'm sorry, Mildred, I can't play bridge with you tonight because I have to watch LeBron. A million little old ladies in Omaha said that about Michael Jordan, even though they didn't know, you know, a three-pointer from a pick and roll. Part of that has to do with the way the game was televised. Leave me out of it. I was just a lucky bystander. But the NBA was on CBS during the Johnson Bird era, and during the Jordan era, which blended over into the Shaq Kobe era, it's on NBC. Mm-hmm. Not only are the games on NBC, when the broadcast landscape was different, when being on a network really mattered, but the promos are on Seinfeld and sure. Cosby and ER and Friends and David Letterman and Johnny Carson and Tom Brokaw's newscast and the Today Show. It's in the cultural water supply. The Dream Team, the first and real Dream Team in Barcelona, is part of that. You think not just of Jordan, but the whole constellation of stars in the NBA then. It was just more central, and the ratings reflect that. And it has nothing to do with how great LeBron is or how great and wonderful to watch Steph Curry is. The cultural impact of Michael Jordan and the NBA itself was greater than it is now.
And, of course, there were so many fewer channels.
That's right.
There wasn't this.
That's right.
And all the other distractions that come with it as well. But one thing LeBron has done, I think, that he deserves credit for, in a way that I think Michael Jordan never really did and never really cared to do, was his cultural impact in terms of helping the community.
Yes.
The ways he's invested in a local school in Ohio, the way that he's prioritized being a father in a very public way, the way that he's become a political activist and really advocated for the African-American community. Can you talk about the comparison there and what that means for LeBron's legacy?
Yeah, Michael, in fairness to him, in the aftermath of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement, pledged $100 million. Now, of course, he's a billionaire, as is LeBron. They're the first kind of wave, Tiger Woods is part of this, of billionaire athletes. Tom Brady must be on his way as well, especially with the Fox deal, which will be his annuity in case he needs it. But obviously, LeBron has been more outspoken. I think in his outspokenness, his intentions are uniformly good. But sometimes, no matter how much you respect and admire someone, you're allowed to disagree with them. And I think that some of the things LeBron has said or tweeted have been ill-considered or disproportionate. That doesn't mean that I disagree with the sentiment that motivated it, but sometimes I think he could be a little more precise about some of the things he says. But that comes with it. Believe me, I know. Mm. If you express anything outside, you know, here's a three-pointer or there's a ground ball to short, right. you're going to get some blowback no matter how reasonable what you say may be. So I get that. And in the big picture, I admire him not just as a player, but as a person. I interviewed him 20 years ago on HBO. It was the first interview I think he had done on national television when he was just coming out of high school in Akron. He'd been drafted by the Cavaliers, but he hadn't played a game yet in the NBA. He's 18 years old, and I was deeply impressed by how mature he was, how level-headed he was. And one of my questions to him, which I thought was reasonable, was, how does it feel to know that if you're not a first-rank Hall of Famer, an all-time great, not enough to become an all-star. If you're not a first-rank Hall of Famer, a lot of people will say you were a bust. Well, it turned out that not only did he meet all those expectations, he exceeded them. And part of that is an expression of character, the way he's taken care of his body, the way he's lived his life. I think he is a genuinely good man, as well as a great basketball player, my occasional disagreements with his pronouncements notwithstanding.
Yeah, and some of those pronouncements have maybe cost him some Mildred from Iowa's fans, you know, over the years as well.
Yeah, maybe.
We are talking with Bob Costas, one of the great sports broadcasters of all time. When we talk about sports, though, your ultimate passion is baseball.
Yes.
And baseball is going to have a lot of changes this year. There's going to be a pitch clock. There's going to be changes when it comes to the shift, which is where defensive players are allowed to stand out on the field. Do you think these changes are good?
Yes. Yeah, I think that they had to happen. Baseball, and I've said this so often that people probably have heard me, at least some portion of your audience has heard me say it before, but this is the best way I can express it. Baseball is supposed to have a pleasing, leisurely pace. That's always been part of its appeal. There's no clock like other sports. Well, now there will be a pitch clock because it was necessary. But it has a pleasing, leisurely pace at its best. It's not supposed to have a plodding, lethargic pace. And that has too often been the case. So the pitch clock will help with that. The minors give us an idea. It won't be exactly the same in the majors. But when they put it in place in the minors, it sped games up by an average of like 25 minutes a game. The length of game matters, but also the pace matters. Outlawing shifts, the reason why teams shift, and the Dodgers, by the way, were among the very best at that. Their analytics were elite. The reason why teams did it was because it worked, but it worked to thwart offense. And you want action. You want that base hit through the hole creates maybe a guy going from first to third, or a guy who can run can steal a base. You know, it seems crazy that they're enlarging the size of bases, but if it increases even by a small fraction, the percentage that the analytics people take a look at to say whether it's worth it to trade the possibility of a base for the possibility of an out, well, if the base is that much closer, first is that much closer, and second is that much closer on the other side, then the split second that is the difference between an out and safe may be changed, and it may lead teams to take more chances. You want the ball in play. You don't want as many strikeouts. Right now in baseball, the average, the overall strikeout rate is roughly equal to Nolan Ryan's career strikeout rate. Now, when Nolan Ryan struck out 25% of the plate appearances, that counts walks and everything else. When he struck out one in every four hitters he faced, on average, some nights it was more than that, but on average, that was why you paid to see Nolan Ryan. But when that's just commonplace.
Random guy.
Yeah, when it's some random guy coming out of the bullpen, and it's remarkable if his strikeout rate is less than one per inning, something's out of whack. When there are more strikeouts overall in baseball than base hits, as there have been in the last few years, you've got a less appealing game.
You know, some Dodger fans are disappointed that they didn't do more in the offseason. Who do you think right now are the favorites in the National League and the American League to win the World Series next year?
I think the Dodgers are still the favorite to win their division, although the Padres are trying like hell to close the gap. Even though the Dodgers drubbed them during the regular season, obviously they won that playoff series, a short series, anything can happen. But I think the Dodgers overall are still the favorite in the West. The Braves and the Mets are very strong in the East. The Cardinals are probably the best team in the Central Division, but they wouldn't want to be in either the East or the West. In the American League, the Astros, even though Verlander defected to the Mets, they're so deep and they're so good. Seattle in their division is trying to improve, and the Angels with Trout and Ohtani someday. You can't waste two of the greatest players ever on a team that never makes it to the postseason.
Get one playoff game in there.
Right. I mean, how the hell can Mike Trout, arguably over time the best player of his generation, be essentially unknown to people outside Angel territory?
Yeah, and that includes a lot of people in Southern California who focus on the Dodgers and don't really even focus on the Angels.
Yeah, maybe,
Another thing that's happening in sports writ large is betting is increasing in a huge way since the Supreme Court essentially legalized sports betting in various states. It's not in place here in California yet, but it will be. It's only a matter of time. There's so much money. What do you make of the impact that's having on the sports world right now?
Well, it's a gold mine that the various leagues could not ignore. You couldn't have expected them to ignore it. But I think it changes over time. It'll change the relationship between fans and the teams they follow. it becomes more transactional and less sentimental. But I don't know what you can do to stop it.
Yeah.
And even though every sports league and its commissioners testified in the relatively recent past before Congress that, no, we don't want any legalized gambling, it'll be the death of sports as we know it, as soon as it became legal, they jumped right on board because, you know, the money train was just too much to ignore. As a side issue, it places the ongoing Pete Rose issue in a different light. Now, everybody understands that what Pete Rose did...
Pete Rose, who was a great baseball player,
yes,
who bet on baseball and then was not been allowed to be in the Hall of Fame,
right,
ever since.
Or be on the ballot.
Right.
Or be on the ballot. Most fans recognize that given what the rules were, he deserved to be banned from baseball, never to be employed by baseball again. But somebody got those 4,256 hits all before the allegations of gambling, which came when he was a manager. And guys who obviously took steroids, whether they got elected or not, they're on the ballot. Pete Rose is 81, 82 years old. No one is nominating him for Citizen of the Year. But justice can be tempered by mercy. What would the harm be if he stood on the stage in Cooperstown and there was some moment of reconciliation between the game and one of the game's greatest players? Because say what you want about Pete Rose. Not only was he a great player, but he embodied many of the things that fans really appreciate about baseball. Right.
Yeah.
Hustle, devotion to the game, all those things.
So you'd vote for him?
If broadcasters had a vote, and if he was on the ballot, it's only writers that vote.
Right.
But if broadcasters had a vote, I would vote for him without hesitation.
We are talking with Bob Costas. We're talking about great broadcasters. Tom Brady is about to become a broadcaster.
Yeah.
Going to start next year, 2024, going to give himself a year to decompress and also learn this. We know there have been so many great players who are not great broadcasters, and that's been a problem in the past.
Right.
You've worked with so many people, including some at the start of this. What's your advice to him in terms of what he should do to study, to learn, to be better at actually being a broadcaster?
Well, first, before he starts, I'm very surprised that this Sunday, Fox is not using him on the Super Bowl. They can tell him, hey, Tom, you want to take a gap year? You want to start in 24? That's fine. But we have the Super Bowl, and you've played in 10 of them, and you're fresh off the field. We don't want you in the booth.
Right.
You know, Greg Olson has that covered with Kevin Burkhardt. But we had a six-hour pregame show.
Sit next to Terry Bradshaw.
Right, a halftime and a postgame.
Right.
You know, you're not going to increase the rating of the game, but you could probably increase the rating of the pregame, especially in the early hours before kickoff approaches, by having him there. I'm very surprised that they didn't insist upon that. But if he is intent...
They're not paying him enough money for that.
Okay. Yeah, right, right.
It's almost $400 million.
Right, right. Geez, Tom, for $400 million, could you give up a weekend? Could you come to Phoenix? We'll charter you in. Anyway, if he's intent, and I think that Tom's nature is, if he's going to do something, he's not going to do it without full commitment. I would say that he has to do some version of what he and Peyton Manning and the best at his position have done. They've got to study tape. They've got to look at it. They've got to figure out not just the points they want to make, but what's the pace and rhythm? Where do you get in and where do you get out? Watch the guys that are the best at it and see if this is what you really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Without diminishing what happens on a pregame show, to prepare to do what Troy Aikman does or what Tony Romo does requires more work, requires more study.
What is your preparation process like, not only for that, but also for interviews? You're known as one of the great interviewers of all time.
Well, when I was doing more interviewing than I'm doing now, back when I had the late night show after David Letterman on NBC, a single guest for half an hour, much like this, and the HBO shows, I would try to get as much background as I could. I never scripted questions, but I'd have bullet points. But as you know, the most important thing is to listen.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody says something surprising in answer to your third question, you can't just look down and move on to your fourth.
Right.
Even if it's something you don't know, it takes you by surprise. Well, it takes the audience by surprise too. So ask the natural follow-up, or if something needs to be challenged or clarified. All the preparation in the world isn't going to help you if you robotically just go questions 1 through 10.
Since we're talking about great broadcasters and learning from people, who would you say are the top three broadcasters you've worked with as maybe partners in the booth or people in the studio, other people?
I've been lucky. I've worked with some great people in the booth, and they were great for different reasons. The most fun was Bob Uecker, who still in his late 80s does the Brewers radio and sounds just the same as he did in the prime of his career. Yeah. Mr. Baseball. You have to be of a certain generation to understand. He was on with Johnny Carson like 100 times.
And also in Major League.
Right.
It was in the Major League
movie. Yeah. I mean, it went a great dry sense of humor. And when he was in a three-man booth with me and Joe Morgan, then the combination was right. Because you could come in with the quick aside. Morgan was more analytical. Morgan right. was a great player. Uke made a career out of making fun of his futility, you know, right. and then I could kind of pass the ball between the two of them. So that was a great combination. I did basketball on NBC in the 90s with Doug Collins. Mm. And Doug, who was a terrific player himself, maybe is the best analyst in the history of the NBA. There are others, but he was really good. Plus, he's a good broadcaster. You can know a lot, mm-hmm. but if you can't figure out how to express it concisely and get in and out, then it's not as effective. I'm leaving people out. In the studio, I loved working with Ahmad Rashad. Mm. And I think that Ahmad was underrated or underappreciated by television critics because they looked at it and said, well, he's not journalistic like Bob, or he's not like Jim McKay or Vin Scully or whatever the hell it is. Yeah, but he was great as Ahmad Rashad. And you should have been around him to see the way athletes responded to him. I had him go to spring training with me once in the 80s. The Cardinals had a great team. They won 3 pennants in the 80s. It was the Cardinals in St. Petersburg. And every player gravitated to him. I'm talking about guys who'd be in the Hall of Fame themselves,
sure.
like Ozzie Smith. And he took batting practice with him. He's such a good natural athlete. He's hitting line drives. That is a quality. If I was starting a sports network and a staff, and you said you can hire 5 or 6 people, Ahmad Rashad would definitely, in his prime, definitely be one of them because you just think of him on the sideline in the NBA, his relationship with Michael Jordan.
Right.
His job wasn't to be Mike Wallace asking him prosecutorial questions. His job was to engage Michael yeah. Jordan, and he did. And every other athlete responded to him in any sport in that way. Plus, he was so much fun.
Yeah.
We got each other, you know, and I could set him up and throw a line his way. I just loved his company.
It was clear that he was Michael Jordan's favorite, too.
Oh, yeah. They're big buddies.
Yeah, yeah.
They're big buddies.
We're with Bob Costas on The Issue Is. We play a few games here on the show. These are quick-fire things.
Yeah.
One of the games is called the name game, which is where we're going to just put up a name, mm-hmm. and then the first thing that comes to mind,
okay.
sort of one word yep. or a real short answer.
Keeping myself to one word is a challenge.
I know. Well, as we've seen. After, okay, here we go. Al Michaels.
Mount Rushmore.
Vin Scully.
Top of Mount Rushmore.
Howard Cosell.
Howard Cosell in one word. Brilliant and obnoxious, depending upon the moment. Shall I tell you a Howard Cosell story that's very brief?
Afterwards. Let's go through this. Mike Tirico.
Excellent and versatile.
Yeah.
Excellent in so many different roles.
Basically, your successor at NBC. Mm-hmm. Kurt Gibson.
Most theatrical baseball moment I have ever witnessed and been part of.
Yeah, and that was part of our last show yeah. with Bob, which people mm-hmm. should watch. Michael Phelps.
Most decorated Olympian. You can argue for others, but if right. it's just the most decorated, he's the guy.
Michael Jordan.
In my view, best basketball player ever.
And finally, Mickey Mantle.
Here's your answer. Here's your answer. Oh, wait, it's the other pocket. It would have been more, you can edit it so it yeah. looks like it's more seamless. Pose it again.
Mickey Mantle.
Here's your answer.
Wow.
That's his 1958 baseball card. The first one I remember getting out of a pack of Topps bubblegum cards when I was 6 years old, growing up on Long Island, when Mickey Mantle was baseball. The Dodgers and Giants had left for the West Coast. The Mets didn't exist yet. The Yankees were the best team in the American League. Mickey Mantle was their glamour boy, mm-hmm. Triple Crown winner, MVP. And later, as luck would have it, Mickey and I became very good friends subsequent to his playing career. And his family asked me to be among the eulogists at his funeral.
And widely regarded as one of the great eulogies of all time, Bob's words about Mickey Mantle as well. Howard Cosell, your quick Howard Cosell story.
Okay, first time I met Howard, who, all kidding aside, I admired.
Right.
He was brilliant at his best, and he was brave. He was journalistically brave. He stood up for Muhammad Ali. Eventually, everyone got it, but he got it early on. He took a lot of stances like that, rubbed people the wrong way, but I admired him. On the other hand, he could be a little overbearing. So the first time I run into him is at the 1983 World Series, Phillies against the Orioles in Baltimore at the old Memorial Stadium. And there's Howard Cosell. I'm a young broadcaster. I've just broken in at NBC. And there's Howard Cosell standing in the doorway of the broadcast booth where he's about to call the World Series with Al Michaels and Earl Weaver. Mm. And he's standing there in that hideous yellow ABC blazer, you know, the toupee perched precariously atop his head. And he's wielding a cigar about half the size of a Louisville Slugger. So it's prototypical Howard Cosell. And I walk up, I say, Mr. Cosell, my name is Bob Costas. It's a pleasure to meet you. And he goes, I know who you are. You're the child who rhapsodizes about the infield fly rule. I'm sure you'll have a fine career. And he flicked a cigar ash and walked back into the booth. And for a split second, I'm thinking, this is the biggest schmuck I've ever met. But then in the next second, oh, no. I just got the full Howard Cosell treatment. Yeah. It's like Don Rickles, you know, ripping you a new one. It's all good. I love it. And here it is 40 years later, I still have a story.
And a great talk show story, too.
Yeah.
All right, finally, to wrap things up, we play a game called Personal Issues. This is to get to know you a little bit better. We put 30 seconds up on the clock.
In 30 seconds, I can't cover all my personal issues.
Yeah, okay. So we start off with, what is your all-time favorite TV show?
As a kid, The Honeymooners. Being objective, Seinfeld. Now,
what is
Curb Your Enthusiasm, kind of related.
All-time favorite musician?
It's tough. Springsteen, I guess.
Love Springsteen. Who's your favorite sports team?
You know, I don't have favorites now. As a national broadcaster, I'm as objective as I can be, but I was a Yankee fan growing up.
Do you have one favorite athlete?
Mickey Mantle.
And best place to relax?
You know, is that the bell that says the 30 seconds are up?
Yeah.
You know, the best place to relax for me, I will not reveal the address, but I spend much of the year in New York, but we have a place in Orange County, which is right on the water on the Pacific Coast Highway. And you and I have gotten together there.
Yeah.
And it's pretty darn relaxing.
That's pretty, pretty nice. Bob, you are the best. I think you're the best that have ever done something like this. And we all love Vin Scully,
thank
the greatest
you very
of
much.
All time.
Thank you.
Have you here on our set doing our little show means the
your
absolute
your little
world.
Show. Your little show.
Yeah.
You realize that over the next 10 years, if you aren't already, you'll be way more significant than me.
No,
that's I'm on the back not nine true. At about the 16th or 17th hole. And you're just reaching, you're not even at the turn yet.
Yeah.
And you've already scored several birdies.
Well, thank you. We're all
have
trying
I strained
to,
that metaphor
we're,
enough?
We're all trying to be more like you. It means the world to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank
Bob
you very
Costas
much.
On The Issue Is. We really appreciate it.
Our thank you to Bob Costas. How great was he? And our thanks to you for listening. We'll be back next week with The Issue Is with another all-time great, George Clooney, a conversation with him about education. That's next week on The Issue Is. For now, I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening.